think we're at the time where I'm supposed to introduce the speaker. Okay. I have known Tim B is going to be our speaker, and I've known him ever since he came to San Antonio, and he's been a good friend ever since. And so I'd like to introduce Mr. Tim.
Tim, I'm an alcoholic.
I did.
Can everybody hear me?
Yep. Yes.
All right. I have a rag in case I pass out here.
This is going to be thirsty.
Well, thank you. And I have a cheat sheet because I'm probably going to forget everything that I had planned on saying. And just let you know it was some good stuff, too. And so this stuff is just what I can pull off this. Said Tim alcoholic. My sobriety date is September of 81, September of 83, and September of 1991, September 15th of 1991. And that's been continuous since then. And the other ones, I just wanted to keep AA fresh. Come back in, get a little boring, go out and try it again. The other thing I'm going to try to do is I've heard so many people say when they get up to speak that they aren't going to curse, and that would limit my ability to speak a lot. So I'm going to try and limit my cursing to Mormonese. I was born in Salt Lake City, Utah. Spent my first 37 years there, some of them as a Mormon. So I've learned how to do that. So, gosh, golly. Oh, I'll give it the old try. We'll see if that forking works out. You know, I'm nervous. I'm very nervous. I haven't spoken in front of a group this big before. And it's a good thing I can't see all the way out in the back. And when I get this nervous, and I tell other people the same thing, but when I get this nervous, I look back and I see all these people that are so put together and, you know, just stand-up citizens. And I remember when you were drunk. I picture it, you know. And that you were showing naked parts of yourself to people that should have never seen naked parts of yourself before. And then I started feeling okay, because I know you then. You know, it's like, check this out, look at this. You know exactly who you are. I had a bunch of jokes that I wanted to tell you, and I'm probably going to have to pass on a lot of those, because I don't know if I can do those in Mormonese. The one that I was told about blackouts was that the guy asked me once, he said, have you ever killed anybody? I said, no. He said, have you ever slept with a man? I said, no. He said, have you ever had a blackout? And I went, yeah, oh, yeah. So, I stand before you not knowing a whole lot of what I did back then. And the bad part about that is some of this trickles in afterwards. So I mentioned my sobriety dates, and I was 29 when I came in. And I was in for close to 2 years, and I went back out again. I was court-ordered to come in, and if I hadn't been court-ordered, I probably wouldn't have stayed. I was headed to prison, and not for long, just 6 months. And my standard joke was, I'm too pretty for prison. And so I'll try AA, and a buddy of mine, I was telling him that about 10 years ago, and he said, you can't use that joke anymore. You're no longer too pretty for prison. You're just old and fat, and they'll just beat you up and steal your food. Which is just as bad to me. You know, don't go messing with my food. And some of those blackouts that keep popping in, I get snippets every now and again. It's like, oh, my God. Some of these things that I've been saying over years and years, when I sat down and thought about it, that never really happened. I've just been saying it for so long that it became real to me, you know, and I lived my life that way. So I'm going to go back way back. I'm 67 years old, came in at 29. Like I said, I grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I had kind of a Huck Finn, Tom Sawyer, Dennis the Menace existence. When I grew up, you know, I rarely wore a shirt. You know, in the summertime, it was cutoffs and bare feet. And I actually had a homemade slingshot in my back pocket that I whittled myself, and I cut the inner tube myself, and I had leather, and I made it up. and I shot things I shouldn't shoot with that. And that was it. We had a river near my house, a field in the back, and buddies that enjoyed the same thing I did. We were catching snakes and swimming in the river. I say river, but if any of you are from Salt Lake City and you know the Jordan River back then, yes, there was water, but the sewage also dumped into that river.
Oh.
And so we we did a lot of sewer shark dodging when we were swimming in that. The only river we had. You had to swim in it. And, a lot of muskrat trapping, and we caught birds, and we raised magpies and hawks. And, it was a great existence as a little kid. And that lasted, I don't know. Things began to fall apart around 12 or 13. My parents are both alcoholics, and they're both dead now. And I remember watching my mom and my dad both drink. They weren't rich, just working folks, and they would buy these quarts of Fisher beer, and they would pour it in a glass, and then I would watch them drink. You know, I'm just a little guy, and so I was looking up, and all I could see was the interior of their mouth as they were gulping this beer down, or booze, as my dad. And I thought, I'm never going to be like that. I'm never going to be like that. And I caught myself several times drinking with my head tilted back, guzzling a beer, thinking, good God, I'm just like that. You know, I hope my son didn't see that. And I'm sure he did. And so my old man was the type of drunk that he got up in the morning and he would take a half pint or a pint, whatever he had available, and he would just down that thing and chase it by a couple of beers. Every morning for coffee, I watched him do it, and I just thought, I'm never going to be like that. That is not going to be me. You know? And it wasn't. For the most part, I didn't drink like that. I didn't have to have liquor in the morning to stop the shakes. You know? I hated hard liquor for the most part. Just hated it. I was a beer guy. And it's not that I wouldn't drink it. I would drink it. I would drink a lot of it if it was all that was around. But I didn't care for it. You know, at a certain point when you get so drunk, it doesn't matter what it is as long as you have it. And I lost my train of thought. Okay, parents. I'm pretty sure that I caught the gene from them, and it's prevalent in my family, and I see it in my nephews, and I've seen it in my siblings, and, you know, my son is a recovering addict, and for me, my old man started to disappear when I was about 12 years old. He would go for a couple of days, and it was a couple of weeks. Then you know, it'd be a month, and he'd come home. And my older sister, there were four kids, and my brother was 9 years older, and he went off to college in New York with a scholarship. And my older sister got pregnant at 17 and got married, and she was 4 years older than me. And so I'm 13 years old. The old man's gone. I've got an 8-year-old sister and a mother that's working her ass off to keep a roof over our heads and clothes on our back and food on our stomachs. And then I was left unsupervised. That's not a good combination with me to let me be unsupervised. Not good at all. And I was pissed off, too. I was really pissed off. My friends had... Dads were staying around. They were going fishing and hunting and doing all those things. And I was just waiting for my old man to come home. And when he would come home, he would pop in and then he would disappear, trying to get out as quickly as he could so he didn't see my mom. And when he did, it was a big fight. It was ugly. It was just 13 stuff. It was horrible. And I started to rebel. You know, I had always done really well in school, you know, without hardly even trying. That began to suffer when I got into high school, because I was was drinking, and I discovered drugs, and I discovered glue. And why does that get the most things? Why? I mean, sniffing glue, come on. Guys put needles in their arms, which I did, but, you know, the sniffing glue is like, oh, that's terrible. You guys were naked in front of other people that should have never seen you naked. As was I. So, if I could swallow it, swig it, snort it, sniff it, shoot it, smoke it, I did it. You know, I did anything that would change my perception, and I did it to extreme, and I did well. I had so many models at my house that I couldn't put together because I had run out of glue and stores that would sell it to me. Anyway, I'm going to be bouncing all over here. That's obvious right now. I heard a lady the other day, I'll tell this one, I heard a lady, it was in the Sober Over 60 meeting, and this really pretty woman, just so put together, and we were talking about relapsing, and this lady had talked about how, you know, everybody's walking down the path, we're trudging that path, and she decided to take another path and skip off on her own. She says, and I'm on the path, and I see this gorilla, so I go over and I decide to boink that gorilla. And she says, and so I'm boinking the gorilla. And she says, the thing that they don't tell you is once you're boinking that gorilla, you're not done until the gorilla's done. And that's what made me think about all the times I'd been out. You know? I'm not done until I had enough. As I said, when I was 13, my old man came home drunk. And he wasn't a violent guy towards me. And he came home drunk, and I was sitting in the front room, and I was watching my little sister, and my mom was at work. And all of a sudden, the whole house shook. And I just, boom. And what he had done is he clipped off one post of the garage, or the carport. And the carport had come down, and the wood had hit the car, and he was in there drunk, and I had to go in there and put the car in park and, you know, turn it off and haul his drunken butt into the house and set him on the couch. And he sat there, and he would go in and out of consciousness. And one minute he'd go, oh, you're a good boy, you're a good boy. And then the next minute his head had come back and smacked the wood paneling, and he'd say, you little son of a, Mormonese, son of a gun. You know, and he'd call me a couple of choice names, and then he'd pass out, and then he'd come back with a nice kid, and then the cursing afterwards. It scared me to death, you know, and I thought, I'm never going to be like that guy. I'm not going to do it, you know. And at 13, I really hadn't been drinking that much, although at 12, I went to jail for my first time. It was between 6th and 7th grade. And we had been stealing booze from our parents' cabinets and beer. And we'd been hiding it in the school pyracantha bushes because nobody went there. There were a bunch of black widows in there, and nobody wanted to go near those bushes, so we knew where to hide it. And we called that stuff Kickapoo juice. And so the summer between 6th and 7th grade, 9 buddies and I got together, and we went over there, and we were drinking, and we were having a good time. We weren't really drunk. We were just a little drunk because there wasn't that much to go around. And next thing I know, I saw the red and blue lights, and and the cop had pulled up there, and then we saw more red and blue lights, and it was a paddy wagon. And they hauled 9 of us, a bicycle and 2 dogs, to jail that night. The cops left their helmets in the back of the paddy wagon. You should never have done that. We did terrible things to those helmets. And all our parents had to come pick us up. And I remember that was the first time my father ever hit me. I was leaving... leaving the station, I said something to one of the cops, and I can't remember what it was, but I'm sure it was foul, and I'm sure it was abusive. And my old man just punched me right in the lip, and he hit me hard. And the cop just looked at him, and I thought, well, arrest the guy. It just hit me. And the cop just went, yes, sir. And they hauled me home. And that was, I mean, he was very apologetic about it afterwards. He said, I didn't mean to hit you. Yeah, you did. And it was a pretty good punch. He had it right on the nose. And again, at about, you know, he just wasn't violent towards me. I got to regress a little bit, too. Sometimes when he would go out drinking, he would take me and my little sister and say he was going to go to the store. And, you know, my little sister and I, we're still in pajamas with feet in them. And he would go to the bar. And he would go into the bar and he'd leave us in the car. And I would sit out there in the car trying to protect this little girl. Many a time I'd have to go into the bar with my little sister in tow looking for my dad. And we find one night I found him because I looked up to the front of the car and he was getting in a fist fight with a guy. And you know, I had never seen that before. I'd never seen two grown men fight, and much less my father. And my father just savaged that guy. And I thought, and this was before my old man had passed out and beat his head on the thing and was threatening me. And I began to fear him at that point when I was younger. Sometime between being like 15, and the incident where he had punched me when I was 12, I found a picture of him. He was in World War II, and he was holding like a bunch of severed heads and smiling. And I thought, oh my God, this guy's dangerous. You know, this guy's, you know, it was war. I don't know. But I began to really fear him at that point. He punched me one more time, and I deserved that one. He'd come home one night, and I was an avid skier. I used to ride the bus up and ski the slopes all the time. But we were poor, and I didn't have decent skis. And one of the runners on my old Woodies was broken, and I was trying to get him to give me some money so I could purchase a pair of skis. They didn't have the money, and he told me they didn't have the money, and I called him cheap and with an expletive on the end. And I remember he hit me on the top of the head. My head went down the ski on the runner and sliced open my face. And he felt so badly about that, he bought me a BB gun, which I employed on torturing my sister for many, many years with rock salt from the water softener downstairs. Boy, I'm all over the place on this thing. Is this over yet?
No.
Okay, anyway, I went to high school and obviously the drinking and the drugging got worse. And after my sophomore year, when I went into my junior year, I pretty much quit going. You know, I would drop in for the tests. I had two art classes, some algebra classes, and I can't remember what the other classes were, but I had another friend who would bring me the homework. He'd bring it to my house after school because he knew that I was off the deep end. And I would do all the homework, and I'd hand it in, and I'd get an A. And I flunked every class except one art class because those were the only two classes that I would ever attend. I flunked them all because of attendance. And I thought, well, this is it. You know, I'm screwed. I'm never going to have anything in my life. I better join the Army. So I went down. I was 17. The minute I turned 17, I went to my parents with the paper, and they almost climbed over the top of each other to sign that permission slip to let me go. And this was during Vietnam, and I thought, wow, way to go. You know, love you too. I had a contentious relationship with my mother after my father had left. I was in my sister had come visit on occasion, and that was my little sister, my mother, my older sister. They were in league, the way I saw it, against me. And so I was always in some sort of shouting match with them of some sort. I remember my older sister, I don't know what the heck it was I said, it must have been choice, But you remember those old tin cups? If any of you are of the age, these old tin cups, they used to have tumblers. They were hard metal. And I saw one of those sailing at me at a really high rate of speed. And I dodged, and it lodged in the frickin' sheetrock. And I'll bet that Mark is still there today. My little sister still owns the house. And I thought maybe it's a better time. It's time for me to leave. Around that time, I remember my mother, again, alcoholic mother, drinking, and she was angry at me one night. And she said, "You know, I wish you were dead." And I looked at her, and I thought, "What?" And she said, "Yeah, I wish you were dead." And I thought, well, God, you know, that kind of sucks. I probably shouldn't stay here. And I moved out. I moved out at 16. And a bunch of us got an apartment. And that wasn't good. You know, 16-year-old boys with their own apartment. And we were working in the summer. And we had money. We had booze. We had drugs. We had girls. I mean, it was great at the moment, you know, but it didn't do well for developing a solid citizen. Anyway, so I joined the Army because I had 17 juvenile offenses with me at the time, and I knew where I was headed. So they wiped out the juvenile offenses. I joined the Army. I was gung-ho until I got off the bus. I had long hair, and I remember the drill sergeant running up to me, and he said, "Aren't you a cute little fairy?" He said, "I'm getting on," and a couple hours later, the hair was gone. And then anybody's in the service, you know what happens next, you know. And I got out of there. I came out an E2, and went to my other training. Came out of PFC, and I thought I was going to Vietnam. And I remember walking into the CO's office because it had an APO that looked like Vietnam. And I said, "I'm 17 years old. I'm sole surviving son. I have an umbilical hernia, and you can't send me over there." And he said, "Son, you're going to Okinawa." And I said, "Excuse me, sir. I'm sorry for taking up your time. I'll leave now." And I shipped off to Okinawa because the Army was going to solve all my drinking and drugging problems because I was going to have discipline, you know. I was going to make something and be all that I can be. And I went over to Okinawa, and oh my God. She spoke of Okinawa earlier. You have lots of room to talk about Okinawa. There's so much over there. Akadama wine and Orion beer and opium on the pot. And oh my God, I was in an MP company and hung out with MPs, and you'd think that would be a problem. But no, the MPs had the best dope on the entire island, and it was free, you know, and that didn't turn out too well. Anyway, I went in the Army, I came out, I went to jail twice in the Army, no big deal. One was an international incident and on Okinawa, and the other one was for fingering a general, and I only got an Article 15 for that one, I'm sorry. I didn't know I was a general. You know, there was a car that drove by. I said, "Soldier, put on your hat." And I flipped him off. And I don't know how he found me. I was a long ways away, but they found me. And the other one was we got busted. We got sent away from the company, three other MPs and myself. I wasn't an MP. I was a computer mechanic. The computer was obsolete, so I was a supply clerk. And we were sitting on this little cane road, and we had a pound of pot, and about half a key, and we were smoking in this old car that we had bought, this great big old car, on a cane road, and we couldn't see anything because there was so much smoke in the car. We didn't see the MPs pull up behind us. There was no inspection. They staged this just for us, and they busted us, and we ended up going to court for that. We're sitting in the courtroom, and I'm thinking, well, this is it. I'm going to the big-time jail now, and it's in the service. I'm probably never going to get out of here. And they dismissed the charges because they had discharged one fellow earlier than us, and so we lucked out that way. And, needless to say, my military career didn't blossom after that. Well, I came back. I went to college. I did that for about a year. Hated it. And decided I'm going to work for a while. Ended up getting married. Had a son, my son Sean. That lasted for just about 8 years. And got a divorce. And I was celebrating... I was celebrating the finality of my divorce, which came to fruition one day before my wedding anniversary. And so I got all gussied up and I went down to this club that was my sister, her boyfriend, he owned the club. And I went down to this club to celebrate, and I, you know, I had all my best stuff. Jacket, patches on the sleeve, gonna go do some dancing, you know. Walked in the club, and that was my last conscious thought of that night. And apparently, so I'm told, at some point in the evening, I walked out on the dance floor, took off my jacket and my shirt, called the bar on, they accepted, and beat the holy bejesus out of me. And they beat me like they owned me. I looked like a grape. You know, my nose looked like a Z. I had cuts and bruises everywhere. And they booted me out. And you know, that's not what sent me to jail that night. What sent me to jail is apparently, now these are no memories of these, this is what I'm told, a Utah Power and Light truck, some guys were coming out of a restaurant where I was sitting out on the front lawn weeping. And they made fun of me. And then they took off in their truck, and I chased the truck down, and I pulled a shovel off the truck, and I started to go after them inside the truck. That's what got me arrested. and I went to jail that night. And that was my second time in jail. Now, I had been working for the Salt Lake Tribune, which is the big newspaper in Salt Lake City, as an artist. And newspapers breed alcoholism. You could do any damn thing you wanted to that paper. I watched a guy, I swear to God, this guy, it's almost over. I watched a guy climb up those stairs that led up to our office. Literally, hands and knees, climb up the stairs, crawl through the front door, crawl up to his desk, do his job, and nobody cared. You know, I don't know how many times I went out for lunch for a beer to the go-go joint, called my boss, they would come down. Several hours later, we came back to work. I would leave work, I would go to the parking lot next door and get high and come back to work. If your name shows up on the arrest report in the paper that you're working for, they frown on that. The second time that happened, the managing editor called me into his office and said, "I see your name on there that isn't a byline one more time, and you're done. You're fired." Nobody ever got fired from there, and I'm at the risk of getting fired. And so I had heard when I was in the drunk tank for that fight, I remember waking up to this big bulbous face. This guy was leaning down at me, and he was one of the denizens of the local park. He said, "Man, you look like crap." I haven't swore once through this whole thing. He said, "You look like crap." And I said, and I thought, God, if he's telling me that I look like crap, my life is over, because he looked horrible. And and he said, "Maybe you should go to AA." And I thought, okay. And that's what I told the officer that let me out on my own recognizance. Afterwards, I'm going to AA. And I did. I started about a week later, I started going to AA. And because I knew I had a problem coming up, because the charges were not good. And matter of fact, the judge had told me that the DA came in at one point, was talking attempted murder. It was a shovel trying to get him in a truck. I didn't try and kill anybody. And let's get real, it's just a shovel. And and then they thought they would try a couple other charges, and then, you know what they finally got me on? Vehicle molestation. And 6 months in prison, 1 year probation. I had to see a drug counselor, alcohol counselor, and a psychiatrist. So I peed in a cup twice a week for a year. And when the year was over, after I'd been in AA, I was indoctrinated. Now, my first meeting that I came into, it was an 11th step meeting. And I sat there and I looked at the lady that was chained, because I sat right by the door, which was right next to the chairperson, and I didn't know that. And I leaned over and they were talking about God, and I said, if they don't stop talking about God, I'm going to leave. And she said, just sit there and shut up and listen. And again, grape, stitches, everything was purple. And I said, yes, ma'am. And I listened, and I don't remember anything of that meeting other than that I stayed through it. And I decided to come back again, and I kept coming back. And I had seen two people that I used to drink with in that meeting, and they were doing fine, which just amazed the heck out of me. And so I decided I would come back and I would try it, even though I'm an atheist at that point. I thought, I'm not going to be able to do this. You know, I'm going to go to jail. And I thought, no, I can't go to jail. Again, too pretty for prison. And so I kept coming back. And when my probation was over, you guys had indoctrinated me. You made me one of the Borg. And I had so much AA in me that I just didn't know what to do with all of it. And typical of people that were in there about a year, a little over a year, I was a big book thumper. You know, I knew everything. Everybody in the program was stupid except for me. And I told them so. My home group was a group called the Huggy Bear Group. And they told me I couldn't speak for my first 3 months, and so I didn't. And at 91 days, I started speaking, and they were never able to shut me up. Everything in Utah, we'd speak from podiums like this. And so I would get up there, and I would tell them how much I hated their guts. And that if I had a gun, I would take them all out and wipe those silly, stupid smiles off their faces. How can you be happy when my life is so miserable? And you know, eventually that ebbed, and I became one of them. Until I wasn't. I wanted to drink again. And close to 2 years, I decided that's it. I'm not an alcoholic. I was just a heavy drinker. You know, I'm not going to prison anymore. I've still got my job. I had been through a divorce. Now I have custody of my son. I'm a single father with custody. I've got the house back. I got most everything that I had done. I bought back. I bought my kid from her. And things were going okay. So I decided, why not drink? You know, I was doing more freelance work off the side than I was making a living. And I thought, this is great. I can finally quit my job. And I did. And I drank everything away in 3 months. I walked out. I was, at the time, it was in 83. And I was doing about $8,000 a month on the side. And I walked out with that. And I went from 8 to 800 to nothing within 3 months. And went out and got another job. Now, they had held my job open for me at the paper. And the editor had said, Tim, don't leave. This is a great job. You do it well. Stay with us. He said, we'll keep your job open for 6 months after you leave. My ego said, I'm not going back to that job. You know, I should have gone back. You know, should have, could have, would have. And I didn't. And I did a number of odd jobs after that. Somewhere along that line, I met my soon-to-be next ex-wife. I made a bunch of money again. I got back into the business, and I was making some money. And I was saving it this time. And she wanted to move back to California. And I said, okay. And I grabbed my son, grabbed my savings and her, and we moved to California. Savings in Utah and savings in California are not the same thing. That stuff went so fast, I was just went like, what the heck happened? And, you know, I was out 3 months, and I came back in. And this time I was, this next round I was in for close to 6 years, just coming up on 6 years. And I had tried to play the game. I tried to say I believed in a God. I tried to say that I was going to follow all these rules. I was everything they said I was going to do, and I was going to believe it. And so I'd had enough of the Mormon religion. I wasn't going to do that stuff anymore. And I knew some Catholics. They're crazy. And so I decided, you know, what I need to do is I need to go to a New Age religion. So I started attending a New Age religion. I became God. I cured myself of alcoholism, and I decided to drink again. That all took me about a year and a half to come to that, to fruition. And I went back out. And there's a part in the book where it says, if I can drink successfully, you guys will take your hats off to me. And I started looking for hats, where I could buy hats in bulk, because I wanted to drop back and say, see, I'm fine. And I bounced in and out, in and out, in and out, until I was back in 91. During that time, there was one time I was out for a solid year that I didn't come back in the doors of AA. Nothing bad happened. I drank when I was driving. I just didn't get caught. There were no fights. I didn't get in any fist fights. I didn't get in any trouble at all. Business was doing well. You know, one night my soon-to-be ex-wife looked at me. She said, "You know, you change when you drink," and that was September 14th, 1991. The next day, I was sober. I sobered up, and I've been sober since then. When I came in this next time, now the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. That kept me sober for many, many years. I had gone through three sponsors. You know, be careful about who you pick as your sponsor, and they didn't work out. So there were three other buddies and I, and we co-sponsored each other. We all had pretty close to the same amount of sobriety, and that worked for a number of years. I went for 16 years without a sponsor, except for these guys, and we would call each other all the time, and keep up on each other, and it kept me sober until I got a divorce. And I moved here, and that friendship had dispersed, and now I'm coming to meetings here, and you guys are doing it all wrong, and nobody tells their sobriety date at the start of the meeting. How crass is that? And this first time I ever heard this, my sponsor, this is my grand sponsor, this is my grand grand sponsor. What the heck is that stuff? You guys are just strange. And and I went to a Freedom Group, and I found a home, you know. And after about, I don't know, I've been going there about 6 months, this fellow named John, he's gone now, he's dead. I had been listening to people talk about God. I'm agnostic at this point. I'm not an atheist. I still don't have a personal God. To this day, I don't have a personal God. That doesn't mean I don't think one might exist. I have hope, you know, that one exists. And not the one where I grew up in, because then I'm just screwed. but, you know, how am I going to make this work for me? You know, six of those steps mention a God. You know, there's so many people that tell me that I have to pray in the morning. That stupid doorknob association. Whoever came up with that thing, that's the dumbest comment I've ever heard in my life. Make a doorknob your higher power. That's just stupid. It is. And I love to tell people that. So I finally found a way. You know, I have a higher power. And a lot of times it's the group. Most of the time, it's nature. Most of the time, it's a life force what's out there. At times. I don't know what it is. I'm not that smart. You know? I can't figure out what it is. I have an idea what probably is what I don't want it to be. But in the meantime, I come to meetings because I get what I need from you guys. All of your experience, all of your strength, all of your hope, that's what I glean. I get that. I listen to what you tell me to do, and I do the things that I should be doing, and I discard the things that I know would be bad for me. You know, I like to say it's a big tent here. You know, it's a great big tent. You got everybody from Mormons to Catholics to Druids to people that bang tambourines to agnostics and atheists. We all fit, you know. There's no master of ceremonies here. You know, we're all the clowns underneath that big tent. We all come out of that car. So I tell people that when you think you've said the dumbest thing in the world, you know that you can never show your face at an AA meeting again. Just be assured there's another clown coming out of that car right behind you. He's got on a bigger nose and floppier shoes, and they're going to say some dumb things too. So, you know, God, it's almost over. let's see, I have to go to the cheat sheet here. Oh, I got a joke for you. You guys want to hear a joke? This blind guy, he's walking around the city. I don't know why. A blind guy's just walking around the city. And he smells a bar. He says, well, I'm going to go in there and get a drink. And he walks in the bar, taps his way to the bar, sits down, orders a beer. He says, you want to hear a blonde joke? And the bartender says, you know what, buddy? You just walked into a lesbian bar. You know, I'm about 6 feet tall. I'm blonde. You're flanked by two police officers, both blonde. There are two biker chicks over there playing pool, and they're blonde. Do you still want to tell that joke? He sat for a minute. He said, not if I have to explain it 5 times. Thought that was a good joke. Yeah, I'm going to get my ass kicked, aren't I? Oh, Piney. there was one other thing I wanted to tell you, and I just can't remember what the heck it was. Oh, yeah. One of my good friends in San Diego, I lived there for 20 years, was a defense attorney. And my ex-wife had been messing around with a Playgirl centerfold, which is the reason why we got divorced. And I was a little pissed off about that when I found out about it. And so I was parked out in front of his house doing surveillance while I was waiting to get my divorce. I'd already filed for divorce. And my buddy called me and said, what you doing? Well, I said, I'm doing surveillance. He said, where are you at? And I said, well, I'm parked out in front of this guy's house. And he said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I have my camera here and a ball peen hammer. And I'm going to pick one of them up if he comes out. And I don't know which one yet. And he said, you know, bail for stalking in California is $100,000. That's $10,000 you're never going to see again. And he hit me right where I really cared about. And I said, that's it. I'm done. And I left. Here's the brilliance of it. He was a junior. I had been parked out in front of his dad's house the entire time waiting for this guy to come out. You know? And not the brightest bulb in the package. So anyway, so I keep coming back, and I keep telling these people that if you come in here and you think you aren't going to be able to make it because you don't have a higher power or you don't believe in a God, I know a lot of people in this program that don't believe in God, a lot. I know a lot of people in this program that will never say that at a meeting with good cause, because I put up with a lot of crap for saying that. And the only reason I do say that is because I don't want to see anybody leave because they don't think they're going to fit because they don't have a God. You can fit. People fit. People have done it for years. People have done it for decades. I've done it for decades. I've been sober 36 years out of the last 38. Granted, not all of them in a row, but I still got all those years. You know? I did it one day at a time, coming in here, putting my butt in a chair, and I got sober through osmosis. Please don't leave. Had I not been court appointed, I don't know if I would still be here. But because I was too darn pretty for prison, you know, I stuck around. Please stick around. This program has changed my life. I can't imagine. Can't imagine going out again. I wanted to smoke pot for the last couple of years. And you know, there's a reason for that. My life has just been in a little bit of a turmoil the last couple of years. And I wasn't quite sure how to deal with it. My mind goes back to, I know how to deal with pain and worry, get messed up so you don't have to think about it. And I finally got over that. I went to Colorado. I went to the pot store with my son. He bought some pot. I got to look at the pot. I got to smell the pot. And I realized that if I take that, if I go home and I smoke that, it's just a matter of time before I got this, I can have a beer. You know, I never got to have that martini. I always wanted to do 007. You know, shaken, not stirred. Beat the crap out of people and have a martini and go off and live my life. That's not going to happen. So, at least I hope, as long as I keep coming here. I speak to 3 alcoholics every day, no matter what. I don't plan it. It just happens. And that's another thing that's keeping me sober, along with you guys. I made it. I'm done.
Thank you, Tim. And he keeps coming back to the golf course trying to learn how to play golf, too. So let's close in the usual way.
Sylvia, I see that you got a cushion.
Nice chair.
Yeah.
The one with my back?